Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the apparent intention of the Israeli Prime Minister to escalate the war in Gaza by invading Rafah and turning Gaza into a tent city of refugees amid the rubble of their former homes. Joining us to discuss this and efforts underway in the House and Senate to strip IRS nonprofit status from NGOs and other foundations supporting Palestinian causes is Lara Friedman, the president of the Foundation for Middle East Peace. Previously, she was the director of policy and government relations at Americans for Peace Now. And before that, she was a U.S. Foreign Service officer serving in Jerusalem, Washington, Tunis, and Beirut. Lara is a leading authority on U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East, with particular focus on the Arab-Israeli conflict, settlements, and Jerusalem, and on the role of the U.S. Congress. Then we'll assess the damage the Supreme Court is doing to the respect for and the credibility of the rule of law in this country, following Thursday's hearing on Trump's immunity claim, which made clear the fix is in to protect the powerful and politically connected who are free to commit crimes, while ordinary folk are subject to the law and its punishment. Joining us is Leah Lipman, Professor of Law at the University of Michigan, who teaches and writes on constitutional law, federal post-conviction review, and federal sentencing. She clerked for Justice Anthony Kennedy of the United States Supreme Court and is now a regular contributor to the Take Care blog and the co-host and creator of Strict Scrutiny, a podcast about the U.S. Supreme Court. Then finally, we'll speak with Alan Lichtman, a political historian who teaches at American University and has studied both the American right and the presidency. The author of The Keys to the White House, A Surefire Way to Predicting the Next President, his prediction system has correctly predicted the outcomes of all U.S. presidential elections since 1984, including the 2016 election, when against all odds he predicted a Trump victory. His most recent books are The Embattled Vote in America, The Case for Impeachment, and 13 Cracks Repairing American Democracy After Trump. And he has a new weekly show at 9 p.m. Eastern on Thursdays at Alan Lichtman YouTube. And we'll discuss how the president's re-election chances look in terms of Alan's 13 keys in a race in which a lot has to go wrong for Biden to lose. And before we begin, I would like to thank our listener donors who keep Background Briefing independent, corporate, and commercial free without paywalls or constant fundraising by making tax-deductible donations to our nonprofit foundation, the Public Truth Media Foundation, at publictruthmedia.org or at backgroundbriefing.org/donate. As we enter this fact-free and violence-prone election year, with much of the country under the cult-like spell of a deranged demagogue spewing constant lies while inciting hatred and violence, help us continue to seek out facts and information to awaken America's silent majority before our democracy is trumped by fascism. And joining us now is Lara Friedman, who's the president of the Foundation for Middle East Peace. Previously, she was director of policy and government relations at Americans for Peace Now. And before that, she was a U.S. Foreign Service officer serving in Jerusalem, Washington, Tunis, and Beirut. And Lara is a leading authority on U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East, with a particular focus on the Arab-Israeli conflict, settlements, and Jerusalem, and the role of the U.S. Congress. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lara Friedman.
I'm very happy to be here, Ian.
Well, thanks for joining us. And I'm interested in talking with you about this bill that's already passed the House and it's in the Senate that would give the Treasury almost unlimited powers to undermine, if not destroy, nonprofits. It supposedly bans financing terrorism, which is already illegal. And the fear is that maybe this is designed to go after NGOs, particularly those that might support Palestinian causes. But before we begin on that, I'd like to just to touch on what's happening now in Gaza. Do you think that Netanyahu's threats to go into Rafah with the military force, which there appears to be some preparations underway for that, do you think that's serious and for real, or is he just using that threat as leverage in negotiations with Hamas over some kind of ceasefire?
So I think the answer is that it can be both. I think there's no question he's been using the threat as leverage, certainly with the international community and with the U.S. government, hold me back, to deflect pressure from other things, you know, so we'll put off doing this, you know, in deference to the international community's pressure kind of thing. And I think at the same time, anyone who has looked at the way that the Israeli army and the Israeli government have prosecuted its war on Gaza, I think it's very difficult to make any credible case that they are not going to go into Rafah. If their argument is that we have to root out every last vestige of Hamas, and that involves basically destroying all of Gaza, you know, just from the perspective of what they've promised to their own people that they will do, not going into Rafah is as good as admitting that the strategy can't work, never could work, and has now been, you know, checkmated without, you know, because this is, if they're stopping, it's not because they are deferential to the world, because it couldn't work. If they're making the case that this is how you root out Gaza, which is how you root out Hamas, which is what they're saying, they have to go in. So I don't see any, and I don't, lacking sustained and serious pressure and consequences on the table from the U.S., the international community, I don't see any possibility that they will not go into Rafah.
But it seems, though, that the Israeli military's only metric is the body count. And that's exactly what the U.S. was mired in Vietnam, was a body count. And they were losing the war, but winning the body count. And there doesn't seem to be any connection between military strategy and any political follow-on. So how is this ever going to work if you don't have a plan for the day after? What do you do with the Palestinians?
I mean, I'm not sure I agree that there isn't a strategy. I mean, I think the objectives they have articulated, which is rooting out and destroying Hamas, were never realistic and never credible. But if the objective is to once and for all erase Palestinian Gaza, so that, you know, Israel doesn't have to go back in and quote unquote mow the lawn every few years, but once and for all erase Palestinian life, Palestinian society, Palestinian history in Gaza. And in the after times, it's dealing with essentially, and I think I said this on your radio show maybe back in November, dealing with a rump refugee population that is left in tent encampments and is viewed by the international community as a humanitarian challenge and really, in their view, take Gaza out of the equation. I think if you're looking at what they've done on the ground since October 7th, that strategy, assuming if you imagine that that is the strategy, that actually does a pretty good job explaining what they've done so far, much better than the stated objective of trying to root out Hamas.
So do you think that the war cabinet and by extension the Israeli public are on board with this, or are they concerned about the damage to Israel's reputation around the world? Because it's certainly, you know, the idea that the Israelis have always been the victims, that's been supplanted by a general feeling that it's the Palestinians who are the victims.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not in the war cabinet. Looking at polling of Israelis or Jewish Israelis, one does not get the sense that the Israeli public in any, you know, by and large has come to the conclusion that they oppose this war, or that they oppose the war, the way the war is being prosecuted, or that they are upset or concerned about the body count. To the contrary, there is strong support for the war. And, you know, from the perspective of at this point, you know, are there going to be repercussions, or is this hurting Israel's reputation? You know, I think to some extent you have an ethos in much of the Israeli population, which is certainly, you know, part of the worldview of people like Benjamin Netanyahu or Itamar Ben-Gvir, which is, it doesn't matter what we do, the world hates us because they're all anti-Semitic. And so we will look out for ourselves, and we will neither ask for permission nor will we apologize after the fact, and people will live with what we do. And, you know, if you look at the protests happening around the U.S. right now, the student protests and around the world, but just looking at the U.S., I mean, the narrative coming out of much of Congress, out of, you know, the legacy Jewish organizations is Israel is the victim here. This is anti-Semitic, not any sort of looking at the actual what's happening on the ground and saying there are legitimate things to be protested here and we should be worried about that. But I suspect that, you know, that there are certainly elements within Israel. I have friends who are certainly concerned about, you know, repercussions down the road. But you know, we're going to talk in a second about legislation, if they can assuage their concerns by saying, we're not worried because Congress will pass laws protecting Israel from anti-Semitic protests on campuses, so we don't need to worry.
Well, obviously, I want to get to that, but just to finish up on Netanyahu, it seems that a lot of American politicians have basically said Netanyahu has to go, including Nancy Pelosi and others. So is it realistic to shift the blame on Netanyahu as opposed to Israel? And at the end of the day, it seems that Netanyahu's electoral strength is even stronger. I think he's got more seats in the Knesset. So I don't see any, I mean, even though Benny Gantz has called for elections in September, it doesn't look as if there's any real serious effort underway to get rid of Netanyahu.
Look, I think for American politicians, and particularly in the Democratic Party, making this about Bibi Netanyahu, who is personally not popular amongst many Jewish Americans, who, you know, liberal Zionists who care about Israel, he is a very useful scapegoat for concerns about what Israel does in general. It's not unlike what the Biden administration is doing by focusing on, you know, a handful of specific settlers, right? Because settlers and settlements are not particularly popular amongst Jewish Americans who vote Democrat. But the reality is, you know, you can focus on a handful of bad apple settlers, but fundamentally, settler violence is state violence. This is something that Israeli human rights groups have been saying for years. They are essentially an arm of the policy of the Israeli government, and they are helped and supported and work in close collaboration with the IDF on the ground in the West Bank. Equally, the Israeli policy in Gaza is not Bibi. It is the government of Israel, and it is across the entire spectrum of the current Israeli government where you have support for and enthusiasm for this policy. If Mr. Gantz becomes the next prime minister of Israel, he is very clear where he stands on this war. This is not a Bibi policy. One can argue that Bibi has specific personal interests in keeping this war going because he's afraid of potential court action against him and being held accountable because it's happened on his watch and yada, yada, yada. But the bottom line is, if he's out of office, anyone who expects the next government to somehow be more, I don't know, concerned about the body count on the Palestinian side, it's not just they're kidding themselves. I mean, the polls make clear in Israel that that's not the case.
So, Laura Friedman, let's turn to this bipartisan bill that would give the Secretary of the Treasury an extraordinary powers to classify any charity or any nonprofit NGO as a terrorist-supporting organization, and it would strip away their 501c3 nonprofit status. And the bill already passed the House of Representatives in November, and it was just introduced into the Senate, a similar bill, by Senators Cornyn and Angus Keane of Maine, independent. So the concern, I take it, is that this is a sort of stalking horse for ways to classify NGOs and that support Palestinian causes. I mean, there's no. Go ahead. Sorry.
No. So first of all, it was introduced in November. It was passed by the committee in November. It moved very, very quickly through the committee process, House Ways and Means Committee, and then it actually passed the full House early last week. It passed as part of the package, or the week before. It passed as part of the package of bills that were moved after Iran's retaliatory attack on Israel, when the House basically canceled all other business and passed, like, you know, a long, long list of anti-Iran pieces of legislation, and then some anti-Palestinian legislation, including a resolution declaring river to the sea to be an anti-Semitic motto, and then also this piece of legislation on NGOs. The argument behind this legislation is that there is a loophole in U.S. Nonprofit, the U.S. Tax-exempt legislation. This is the IRS, the rules on the IRS giving tax-exempt status. And what they're basically saying is, fine, it's illegal to give money to terrorist organizations. These are groups that are designated by the State Department, by the Secretary of State, as foreign terrorist organizations. Under law, you cannot support them. And if the Justice Department believes an American citizen is doing that, they can file criminal charges against you. You get to go to court. You are tried. You can try to defend yourself. There's a criminal process there. What they're arguing is that there is a quote-unquote loophole in tax-exempt law, which allows groups that are funding or supporting terrorism to still enjoy tax-exempt status, and therefore that means taxpayers are supporting terrorism. The problem with that argument is, first of all, that it's illegal, right? So there isn't a loophole. If you're funding terrorism, if you're violating U.S. material support law, the Justice Department can charge you criminally and put you in court. what they're saying is, well, that process of going through the courts and the Justice Department, it's long, it's not efficient, we need something more direct, faster. So what we're going to do is have legislation that makes the Secretary of the Treasury, the prosecutor, the judge, the jury, and the executioner, in basically decreeing that U.S. nonprofits are terror-supporting organizations. And if the Secretary of Treasury deems an organization as such, that means that he says, he or she, now currently, he says, you are, in my mind, guilty of supporting a designated foreign terrorist organization. You are stripped of your 501c3 status. You have the option of saying, oh my goodness, you're right, I'm sorry, let me cure this in some way. And if they accept your cure of the sin you've committed, you can continue operating, but you can only do that once every 5 years. So if they come at you twice, you're done. The other option you have is to say, no, 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 you're wrong, and present all the documents you want to try to prove a negative, because we know how easy it is to prove a negative to the IRS. And then you have the option of having this heard in an internal IRS court, right? Which is not a court of justice. It's not, you don't have due process. Effectively, they're creating a parallel way to accuse American citizens of supporting terrorism, material support for terrorism, while suspending normal due process. And it's not speculation to say that the goal of this is to get at organizations supporting Palestinians. If you listen to the hearing back in November, when they had a hearing on anti-Semitism, you know, the people from various campuses, and they talked about this legislation, they made clear they are looking to weaponize what are pretty attenuated links between the Holy Land Foundation, which is an organization that back in the 80s, I think, or early 90s, was found guilty of material support for terror. They are arguing that another organization that exists today, American Muslims for Palestine, AMP, is a successor to the Holy Land Foundation, even though it has not been found so under law. And they're arguing that AMP created SJP, and therefore, following that line, SJP is connected to Hamas, and therefore we can strip away SJP's nonprofit status. So that's it's a very direct line what they say they want to do with this. But the implications are obviously much bigger.
So how different is this from Governor Ron DeSantis of Florida accusing SJC Students for Justice of Palestine of supporting Hamas, and he ordered it shut down, but then facing a lawsuit, they had to walk that back?
Well, I mean, it's one thing. Look, you know, the head of the Anti-Defamation League has suggested that SJP and JVP are in league with terrorists, and recently said that they are proxies for the Iranian government. Anyone can say anything they want. Under normal process, you have American citizens, including American citizens running and working at nonprofits, have a right to due process. If the Justice Department believes they are violating U.S. anti-terror law, there can be charges, you can have lawyers, you can make your case and actually get due process. This is suspending due process, right? This is something that is decided by the Secretary of Treasury by fiat, with virtually no ability in it to challenge it or to gain any sort of justice if you have been unfairly targeted. And the implications of it, you know, people are saying, you know, a lot of times when we talk about lawfare, and I want to be clear, some people love this law. I mean, my view on this is, like it or hate it, you know, at least be honest about what's going on. Information is good. I'm sure there are people who are hearing what I'm saying here and saying, great, let's write letters saying, pass this thing into law as fast as you can, just as there's some people who don't like it. That's fine. This is your right as Americans. But what you've set up here is a structure that, you know, passed into law can be used against any nonprofit if someone can make an attenuated connection to terrorism. And, you know, to sort of think that, you know, we used to talk about this with the anti-BDS laws, where people would say, you know, this law that they're passing across the country that basically punishes people for boycotting Israel by denying them the ability to have state contracts or whatever. They say, well, I don't really care about Palestine work. I don't want to get mixed up with this. Don't bother me with this issue. And then, as many of us predicted, you know, just a few years later, we see these laws being used as a template to target other things like climate change protest or, you know, ethical investing or, you know, people who want to focus on, you know, DEI. These are broad tools for repressing free speech. And maybe you like that, but let's at least be honest about what this is.
So just in closing then, Lara Friedman, is this being driven by donors? Because after all, President Biden, it seems to have been concerned about donors. That's why he rushed to support Netanyahu without recognizing the backlash from students, the younger vote that he needs. So I think he's having obviously caught between that. I mean, it seems like the same donors to politicians are also the same donors to universities that are forcing all kinds of blame on the pro-Palestinian demonstrators on the basis that this is all about anti-Semitism.
Look, I mean, I don't know. I mean, people can do their research on this and report. If you look at the hearing where this came up in the House Ways and Means Committee, Anti-Defamation League is part of that. The Foundation for Defense of Democracies was part of that. I think you have a confluence of interests here between organizations that strongly want to quash any organizing, activism, serious free speech, protest that is critical of Israel. And you have a confluence between them, who are, include groups like the Anti-Defamation League and the American Jewish Committee on that side, and with some of the very illiberal Republican members of Congress who are opposed to quote-unquote woke academia, right? And we've seen this now for months. We've seen this in the hearings around the schools. And it's sort of, you know, there's something fascinating about seeing forces that ostensibly on the Democratic side have been the standard bearers of free speech and the right to protest for generations, now standing shoulder to shoulder with people who are very clear that their goal is to repress free speech and free thinking on things they don't like. This isn't really about anti-Semitism for them. Anti-Semitism is a useful tool for getting these Democrats or these progressive forces on board. And the progressive forces or Democrats are saying, it's, you know, these people's illiberalism and anti-woke ideology is a useful tool for repressing criticism of Israel. And here we are.
Well, Lara Friedman, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Lara Friedman, who's the president of the Foundation for Middle East Peace. Previously, he was the director of policy and government relations at Americans for Peace Now. And before that was a U.S. Foreign Service officer serving in Jerusalem, Washington, Tunis, and Beirut. Lara is a leading authority on U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East, with a particular focus on the Israeli-Arab conflict, settlements, and Jerusalem, and the role of the U.S. Congress. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back with an assessment of the damage the Supreme Court is doing to the respect for law and the credibility of the rule of law following Thursday's hearings on Trump's immunity claim, which made clear the fix is in to protect the powerful and the politically connected who are free to commit crimes, while ordinary folk are subject to the law and its punishment. And joining us now is Leah Libman, who's a professor of law at the University of Michigan, who teaches and writes on constitutional law, federal post-conviction review, and federal sentencing. She clerked for Justice Anthony Kennedy on the U.S. Supreme Court and is now a regular contributor to the Take Care blog and the co-host and creator of Strict Scrutiny, a podcaster about the U.S. Supreme Court. Welcome to Background Briefing, Leah Libman.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, thanks for joining us, Leah, and how did last Thursday's Supreme Court hearing on Trump's immunity claim? Most legal observers thought it was pretty strange, if not somewhat absurd, for the Supreme Court to take up the case in the first place after this appeals court, particularly Judge Pan, had gotten Trump's attorney to admit that it was okay for SEAL Team 6 to assassinate a political rival. And it would seem to me at that point the issue should have been closed, but they took it up. And now there's a fear that not only have they taken up a lot of time and wasted a lot of time, now they won't even have a rule June probably. And if they remand it back to the same court that basically dispensed with it, the appeals court, then it'll take even more time and never the American people will never learn about what happened on January the 6th in terms of a court of law looking at all the evidence.
I think that that's right. Based on how the argument went, it seems like there's probably a majority of justices who are not just going to straight up affirm, that is, let stand the Court of Appeals decision. Doing that would allow a trial to proceed. Instead, it seems like they're going to ask the court below to reflect their view that perhaps there are parts of the indictment, which again involve allegations of attempt to overthrow the government. It would suggest that the court thinks the court needs to make a decision about whether some of those allegations actually would fall within the scope of the president's official duties, which of course is absurd. And that would, as you know, likely lead to a situation which they would have delayed any trial until after the election. And I think in some ways what was most stunning about the argument was the justices, or at least the Republican appointees, many of them, their suggestion that what is most shocking about any of this is the prosecution of a former president for an alleged effort to overturn the government, rather than the events leading up to and including January 6th and Trump's alleged involvement in that.
Well, that was what was surreal about the hearing, Leah, because Trump-appointed Justice Brett Kavanaugh said, "I'm not concerned about the here and now. I'm more concerned about the future." Justice Alito said he didn't want to talk about the particular facts. He'd rather talk in the abstract. And then Trump-appointed Justice Neil Gorsuch said, "We're writing a decision for the ages." So they clearly did everything they could to avoid what the indictments are about, what Jack Smith's case is about. Aren't they hearing the case? Isn't that what this should be about, this hearing?
It's absolutely what it should be about. And the idea that they needed to take this case in particular in order to establish some definitive legal standard that would determine the special immunity for all time makes no sense, because they can always wait for a case in which the court's determination of a legal standard or legal test is actually outcome determinative. But here, as Justice Sotomayor attempted to point out repeatedly, there is just no sensible account for how the allegations in the indictment are plausibly related to the president's performance of the president's official duties. And so you don't need to determine the exact bounds of presidential immunity in this case, because under no sensible understanding of presidential immunity would the allegations in the indictment be entitled to immunity. Again, they involve allegations that an outgoing president attempted to refuse to leave office, interfere with the peaceful transition of power, and effectively try to overthrow the government, again, based on the allegations in the indictment. And so there's no need to use this case to articulate the standard for all time of presidential immunity. And it was shocking to hear the kinds of cases that the Republican appointees reported to be concerned about in the future. So for example, Justice Alito said, "Well, if there isn't immunity, shouldn't we be concerned that some president will refuse to leave office because they're concerned about prosecution?" As if to suggest that if Donald Trump knew he had immunity, he would not have done all of the things that Jack Smith alleges he did in this indictment. It's just absurd.
Well, I think it's pretty rich and an amazing double standard that Brett Kavanaugh should say, "I'm not concerned about the here and now, I'm more concerned about the future." This is the same Brett Kavanaugh who worked with Kenneth Starr on the impeachment of President Bill Clinton over a private sexual dalliance. I mean, isn't that amazing that somehow that was a serious enough case to deal with, to impeach a president, and yet what Trump did and his followers did on January the 6th is not serious. Like, it's rewriting history, like the MAGA people are rewriting history. That, oh, it was a walk in the park, it was a love fest, everybody, you know, the only violence was because of Antifa. I mean, this is part of it that I find just so appalling, is that the Supreme Court of the United States has joined up with this MAGA denial movement.
I mean, it was, again, very strange to listen to this argument. I mean, at one point, Justice Kavanaugh started reading from Justice Scalia's dissent in Morrison versus Olson about how the independent counsel statute, you know, was actually unconstitutional because it created all of the risk of different problems. And of course, participated in an independent counsel investigation, the Starr investigation, that you note that in some ways revealed many of those problems. So it was a little rich to hear him expressing all of the concerns that he felt existed with the independent counsel. Also, Jack Smith is not an independent. He is a special counsel. The independent counsel statute lapsed. And you're also right that it felt like at various points the justices were engaged in false equivalencies in which they were minimizing the seriousness of the events of January 6th. So at one point, Justice Neil Gorsuch pointed to two of the charges that special counsel Jack Smith has brought against Donald Trump. These are the charges related to a federal statute, 1512C2. And Neil Gorsuch basically asked a lawyer for the government, well, couldn't a president just be prosecuted for leading a civil right that they had under these statutes, as if equating that with what happened on January 6th? It was absurd, bizarre, and extremely blunt.
So, Leah Littman, just to sort of broaden this out, it seems to me that what's at stake here is the respect for the law and its credibility. Because when the highest court in the land makes it clear that the fix is in and that the powerful and the privileged like Trump will in effect trump the rule of law, and that us poor stiffs are subject to the penalties of the law, however people like Donald Trump are free and they can skate and they can do no wrong. That's the message they're sending, isn't it?
That is definitely a very strong signal that they are sending, because they are enabling Trump to evade one measure of accountability and effectively granting him the kind of immunity that comes from immunity before an election on charges of election interference. So that is one way in which they are enabling, you know, someone to get off scot-free and not face any accountability. But yes, more broadly, by suggesting the possibility that some of the allegations in the indictment are entitled to immunity, they are suggesting that some efforts to overturn the government and refuse to leave office could themselves be not subject to any kind of accountability whatsoever. And that is extremely concerning.
So if these far-right justices in this far-right Supreme Court are in fact political operatives and rogues, in effect should be wearing MAGA hat, why are they doing this? Why are they bending over backwards, just like Judge Eileen Cannon is down in Florida, to help Trump and to prevent the American public from knowing about what he really did, even though they know about it from the House hearings? But a court of law, obviously, like the case underway in New York, provides a lot more information. And voters deserve information about the presidential candidates they're voting for. But this Supreme Court appears to be poised to deny that to the American people. So I'm trying to why they're doing this. Is it the same reason why so many in the House and Senate on the Republican side are supporting Trump, even though many of them privately can't stand him? What is this about, do you know?
A bit perilous to speculate about their precise psychological conscious motivations for what they are doing. I think it is perhaps a mix of different factors for different justices. I think for some of them who retire soon, and they certainly don't want to retire under a Democratic president. You know, here I'm thinking of possibly Justices Alito and Thomas. Another possibility is, you know, because they are, you know, Republicans who are immersed in Republicans' worldview, it's possible that some parts of them have bought into the idea that Trump is being unfairly targeted in a way that it's also possible that some of them view, you know, the threats that a Democratic administration faces as, in their view, a greater threat to liberty than, you know, a future Trump administration, and that is informing their calculus of the considerations. I mean, just to take an example of this, in some cases, we have heard the Republican appointees liken some of the things that President Joe Biden has done, whether it's granting debt relief to students or attempting to require vaccinations in order to prevent the spread of COVID. They have likened that to egregious abuses of executive power in the past, like, say, the forced internment of Japanese American citizens during World War II. And that suggestion, again, seems to suggest a worldview that is so deeply ensconced in Republican politics and that ideological worldview that it would be difficult for them to put that aside entirely when looking at this case. And I think, you know, others of them are in many cases not involving Democratic presidents, at least strong proponents of executive power. Here I'm thinking of Brett Kavanaugh. So I think it's probably different considerations for different justices, but none of them should be reassuring in the least.
Well, is it a bit like William Barr, the former Attorney General, who recently said he was going to vote for Trump, even though he's been trashing Trump lately, and at one point described him as a sort of a 9-year-old boy who pushes the glass to the edge of the table so that it would fall over, and it generally trashed Trump's revisionist history about the big lie about how he won the elections, and actually was quite helpful in terms of the House inquiry into January the 6th. But nevertheless, in spite of all that, and he was there in the room, he knows this person. And ironically, because Trump made fun of that.
It's very much like that. That is emblematic of a worldview where even though they recognize some ways in which Donald Trump is a serious threat to American democracy, in their view, the prospects of Democrats exercising political power are almost always going to be worse than basically anything a Republican president could do.
So is there also the aspect that we've learned about through reporting about the contacts between Justice Clarence Thomas and Alito with billionaires, with their buddies who've been giving them free vacations and all kinds of perks, including in the case of Clarence Thomas, an expensive motorhome for him to hang out with the regular folks that he claims to feel identity with, as opposed to the billionaires that he seems to be far more comfortable with. So is it a billionaire agenda? Is that a part of it, the idea that we want Trump back because in 2025, Trump's tax cuts expire for the super rich, and if Biden comes in, he'll let it sunset, as opposed to Trump, who'll not only renew the tax cuts, but actually give them even more breaks?
I mean, it is likely that hanging around with billionaires all the time gives Justice Thomas a skewed perspective on different risks facing the country and which problems are the most serious facing the country. So again, if you were just speculating about like possible contributing factors to what the justices are doing, yes, right, being constantly surrounded by billionaires who view the Biden administration as bad because it is attempting to chip away at economic inequality is probably also contributing to some of the justices' perceptions of the relative risks of, you know, a Biden administration versus a Trump administration.
So just in closing then, Leah Littman, what do you think's happening with the American people? Are they following this? Are they as outraged as I am, and I suspect you are, that the highest court in the land, the upholder of the law, should not be signaling that the fix is in for the rich and powerful, and you poor stiffs have to obey the law, whereas the rich and powerful can do what they want? That's not a very good signal.
It's certainly not a very good signal, but I also think it takes a lot of time to follow everything that the court is doing. Not everyone has 3 hours, you know, on a weekday to listen to the absolute clown fest that was the Supreme Court argument. All of the things that the Supreme Court did up until now in the case to ensure refusing to hear Jack Smith's request for the court to hear the case before the Court of Appeals did in order to speed it along, how they have granted, you know, such requests in other cases, like the emergency medical abortion case that they argued the day before the Trump immunity case. And so I think it takes a lot of effort to follow exactly what the court is doing and see how horrifying it is. But I do think that if people, you know, had the bandwidth to kind of follow everything that the court is doing, you know, it's my hope, yes, they would be appropriately horrified.
Well, Leah Littman, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Leah Littman, who's a professor at law at the University of Michigan, who teaches and writes on constitutional law, federal post-conviction review, and federal sentencing. She clerked for Justice Anthony Kennedy of the United States Supreme Court and is now a regular care blog and the co-host and creator of Strict Scrutiny, a podcast on State Supreme Court.
We're going to take a brief station break and back look into the president's re-election chances in terms of a prediction system that has correctly predicted the outcomes of all presidential races since 1984 in a race which a lot has to go wrong for Biden to lose. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Alan Lichtman, a political historian who teaches at American University and has studied both the American right and the presidency, the author of The Keys to the White House, A Surefire Way to Predicting the Next President. His prediction system has currently predicted the outcomes of all presidential elections since 1984, including the 2016 election when, against all odds, he predicted a Trump victory. His most recent books are The Embattled Vote in America, The Case for Impeachment, and 13 Cracks Repairing American Democracy After Trump. And he has a new weekly show at 9 p.m. Eastern on Thursdays at Alan Lichtman YouTube. Welcome to Background Briefing, Alan Lichtman.
Thank you so much.
Well, thanks for joining us, Alan. And your profile in an article at The Guardian, a lot would have to go wrong for Biden to lose. Can Alan Lichtman predict the 2024 election? Obviously, I'd like to talk to you about your keys and how they apply, even though you're not going to announce the results until August, I believe. But let me just start by what happened on Thursday, because I don't think I've ever seen anything like what happened in the Supreme Court immunity hearings. It just feels to me like what happened on Thursday is that the respect for the law and its credibility, it was just trashed by the highest court in the land, because these right-wing justices were making clear that the fix is in and that power and privilege trump the rule of law. And at the very least, if they don't let Trump escape, they'll delay the trial so that the American people won't learn about what happened on January the 6th until after the election. So it seems to me that this is just in our face, that you rubes out there have to obey the law, but our friends in high places don't have to.
You know, it really astounds me that ordinary people really think that Trump playing the system like a fiddle somehow protects and benefits them, when, of course, as you point out, it's exactly the opposite. It shows that there is a blatant double standard between ordinary folk, you know, who are chewed up by the criminal justice system all the time, and someone like Trump, who is rich and connected right up to the United States Supreme Court. It would be a tragedy, and I do not use that word lightly, if the trial of Donald Trump for disrupting our democracy, indeed undermining our democracy, is postponed till after the election. The American people have an absolute right to know whether Donald Trump is criminally liable for what he did in trying to overturn the fair results of the 2020 election. And so far, the Supreme Court has played right into his hands. Way back in December, Jack Smith said, look, this is going to come to you. You've got, you know, let's decide this now rather than delay. They said no. Then it went to the appeals court, and they issued a very strong opinion, clearly striking down the absurd idea that a president could order Team Seal 6 to kill his opponents and get away with it unless he was impeached. He can just threaten the Senate and not get impeached. It's just, the whole thing is absurd, and yet the Supreme Court delayed a week and a half, 2 weeks, even after that, and said, oh, we'll finally take the case and we'll schedule it for the last day when we have hearings on the term. And I'm afraid you're right. Even if they don't, you know, grant, you know, absurd presidential immunity, they're very likely to send it back to the lower courts for absolutely no reason. Even Trump's attorney admitted that all the charges that Jack Smith brought had nothing to do with the president's official duties, but were pursuant to his private acts as a candidate. Even Trump's lawyers admitted that. So why in the world do we need to go back to the lower courts except to delay? Gosh, I just hope you're wrong, Ian, but I don't think so.
Well, but the justices, the right-wing justices, who are a majority, were going out of their way to avoid talking about January the 6th, and they're playing right into this revisionist history on the part of the MAGA movement to make it seem like it was a walk in the park, just a love fest, and if anything went wrong, it was all Antifa's fault.
Yeah, well, they didn't even want to deal with the details of the indictment, which astounded me, because that's the role of the court. You know, this is being brought by Donald Trump to claim that this indictment, this particular indictment, not some generic indictment, this particular one brought by special counsel Jack Smith should be dismissed because I have immunity. And the only conservative justice, remarkably, who actually looked at the indictment itself was Amy Coney Barrett, who went through each element of the indictment with the attorney for Donald Trump, who kept saying, yes, this is private action. So even if the Supreme Court wants to provide some shield for actions taken while, you know, official president is conducting official duties, they don't have to remand this case back to the lower courts because Trump has admitted that what I'm being charged with has nothing to do with my official duties.
So, Alan, let's turn to your keys to the White House. And again, you've predicted accurately all of the results of presidential elections since 1984, including 2016, when against all odds you predicted Trump would win. The 13 keys are party mandate, contest, incumbency, third party, short-term economy, long-term economy, policy change, social unrest, scandal, foreign military failure, foreign military success, incumbent charisma, and finally, challenger charisma. So the one, of course, that jumps out at me is number 9, scandal, because Trump is the vehicle of sleaze, and we hear nothing but sleaze going on in the trial in New York, which is certainly going to go on for weeks, and I dread the thought of having to cover it. I mean, in a curious way, Alan, I must say it's amusing to see Trump comes out of the court and they build a little cage for him, which sort of looks like a precursor of a prison cell.
Yeah, now the way this works is the keys are measured only against the party holding the White House. The proposition behind the keys, the well-tested one that's worked retrospectively since 1860 when I developed the keys and prospectively since 1984, is that American presidential elections are essentially votes up or down on the strength and performance of the White House party. So whether the scandal key is true or false pertains to Biden. And as you and I have discussed before, for years, the Republicans have tried to pin something on Biden and have come up absolutely empty. And recently, their supposed smoking gun witness, Mr. Smirnoff, who claims Biden received a bribe in Ukraine, turns out to be a liar, was arrested by the FBI for lying to the FBI. And it turns out he got those lies from Russian intelligence services. And, you know, everyone's forgotten this, but I would go back to the hearings on the original impeachment and the testimony of Fiona Hill, a brilliant Harvard PhD who was Donald Trump's own expert on Russia and Eastern Europe. And she explained way back when that all these things that are being mongered by Giuliani and Trump and their associates are directly coming from Russian intelligence services. And Lev Parnas, who was one of Giuliani's right-hand persons recruited by Giuliani to help with the scheme in Ukraine, recently testified, yes, you know, what's going on here is these people, you know, Trump and his associates, are simply propagating Russian intelligence propaganda. And that's truly chilling and truly frightening. We haven't heard anything like this since the America First movement in the late 30s and early 40s that sought to appease Hitler and oppose all aid to any of the allies resisting Hitler.
So is there going to be, even though the keys are about the incumbent, the challenger, of course, is facing so many lawsuits, and we've just discussed the possibility that the January 6th case in Washington will never be heard until after the elections because the fix is in with the Supreme Court, who might as well be wearing MAGA hats and along with their robes. And then the one down in Florida, is the fix is in there because it's pretty clear that the Trump-appointed judge down there will just bend over backwards to give him a free pass. The Atlanta case is screwed up thanks to the DA's dalliance. And the only one that seems to be able to, you know, lay a glove on him is the one in New York, which is kind of ironic. Everybody dismissed that as the weakest case. So how does the legal situation look to you? And has it ever been like this in your research with the keys to all these presidential elections? Ever been an incumbent or a challenger that's had so many brushes with the law?
Not even close. I mean, we are in totally uncharted waters. As you say, not only has no former president ever faced criminal felony indictments, but no major party candidate, period, has ever faced major felony indictments. And look, I'm not psychic Gene Dixon. I don't have a crystal ball. I'm not Mike Johnson, who claims the Almighty speaks to him. My system is based on history. It's very robust. As I said, retrospectively, it goes all the way back to the horse and buggy days of American politics. But, you know, history can change unpredictably if it's cataclysmic enough. And who knows if, you know, Trump is convicted in New York. And, you know, the mainstream media has been just derelict in covering this, calling it the run trial or the hush money trial. It is not a hush money trial. Trump is not on trial for paying hush money. It's an election fraud trial, very similar, although not in the same magnitude as the January 6th trial. Trump falsified business records to deceive the American people and the government about his campaign efforts to silence Stormy Daniels. So it's unknown what might happen if he's convicted in New York. And, you know, I want to spend a moment on the Florida case, which is another tragedy. You know, she has been slow walking it. The Florida case could take place tomorrow. Everything is known about the Florida case. He's admitted he took these documents. He admitted he didn't return them. He said that they belonged to him. You know, all the facts are already known. It's not a complicated case. Did you take these documents? Yes. Did you not return them when you were subpoenaed? Yes. Are these national security documents? Yes. And he's not being tried under the Presidential Records Act, which is a civil act. He's being tried under the Espionage Act, which was passed in 1917 before there was even a classification system. Dead simple trial. It could take place tomorrow. And maybe, but maybe, as before, if she unconscionably makes rulings on this, the 11th Circuit will slap her down. I have still some dim hope that that trial will take place before the election.
So do you think then that there is, let me rephrase that. One of the keys, number 10, is foreign military failure. And, of course, that certainly hit Jimmy Carter with his aborted rescue attempt in Iran to rescue the hostages.
That's a classic example.
Yeah, but let's assume that within that category? Because it seems to me that what Biden's really running against here is Netanyahu, Putin, and Mohammed bin Salman, along with the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court fix is already in, as far as I can tell.
God, I hope you're wrong, but I don't think so.
Well, but look at the damage that
no, I agree.
Netanyahu's already doing to him, and he wants to continue that war, and now he's going to escalate and go into Rafah. So this could go on for a long time. And
yes, that's a real...
And you're on a university campus. You know what's happening on the campuses. So none of that is good for Biden. And then you got the possibility of collusion between MBS and Putin to jack up the price of oil in the fall.
Absolutely. You know, here's the tragedy in Israel. You have the two worst possible antagonists, Hamas on the one hand and Netanyahu on the other hand, the worst possible leader of Israel at this time. And the sad thing is, Biden is reaping the whirlwind from Netanyahu, and Netanyahu is a creature of the American right wing. He's the Israeli Donald Trump. Joe Biden is not responsible for Netanyahu. The American right is the ones who pumped up Netanyahu, and yet here is Biden, the victim of Netanyahu's misguided policies that have alienated Israel from the entire world. It's an absolute tragedy that you have Netanyahu in charge and then, you know, Hamas on the other hand. And I agree with you. You know, it's very perilous. The Russians will do everything in their power to try to subvert this election again and make sure that Trump wins. And I wouldn't put it past them. I'm not sure they have the power to do it, but I wouldn't put it past them to try to trash the world economy in the course of it. So that's why I haven't made a prediction. Things are so fluid. So much is yet to come.
Well, MBS, though, during the Trump administration, over the objections of Homeland Security because of critical infrastructure, Trump allowed the Saudis to buy the biggest oil refinery in America at Port Arthur in Texas on the Gulf Coast. And now that it's owned by the Saudis and by the MBS, they could shut down for maintenance and jack up the price. There's so many tools at their disposal. But just the last thing on Netanyahu, as we wrap up, Alan, is people forget that Netanyahu came over here just before the Gulf War and addressed the Congress and talked about how an invasion of Iraq and taking down Saddam Hussein would bring peace and security and love and freedom and
I remember that, to
the Middle East, and it'll all be, you know, milk and honey. I mean, what, this guy's a complete incompetent. He always has been.
He's been a disaster from day one, and he is a disaster now. And it is, you know, an ironic tragedy that what Netanyahu is doing is rebounding against Joe Biden, who had was opposed to Netanyahu along with other Democrats right from the start.
Well, Alan, I thank you for joining us. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Anytime.
And again, I've been speaking with Alan Lichtman, a political historian who teaches at American University and has studied both the American right and the presidency, the author of The Keys to the White House, A Surefire Way to Predicting the Next President. His prediction system has correctly predicted the outcomes of all U.S. presidential elections since 1984, including the 2016 election, when against all odds he predicted a Trump victory. His most recent books are The Embattled Vote in America, The Case for Impeachment, and 13 Cracks, Repairing American Democracy After Trump. And he has a new weekly show at 9 p.m. Eastern on Thursdays at Alan Lichtman YouTube. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Evan Green to help us sustain this program into the future and ensure it remains free to all. Please take a moment to support us by going to backgroundbriefing.org/donate or publictruthmedia.org, where you will find our nonprofit Public Truth Media Foundation, where your tax-deductible donations, large and small, keep us broadcasting. And if you've missed any of today's programs or would like to explore our vast archives, you can find us at backgroundbriefing.org, where we include extended interviews searchable by topic and have made it easy for you to sign up for daily email updates that provide links to resources, articles, and books discussed on the program. Also, you can find links there to subscribe wherever you get your podcast. and we encourage your ratings and reviews on these platforms. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at Ian Masters Media, and please do help us reach more listeners by sharing this program with friends, family, and colleagues. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. The guy that lived next door in 305 took the kids to the park and disappeared by